Movie buff specialists Phil and John are back. It has been such a long time. That was the longest break we've taken since we started this thing. I'm sure plenty of you thought that we had forgotten all about you and that we were never, ever, ever coming back. But here we are as we continue counting down our 100 favorite films of all time. It has been a little bit over a month. We did get a later start on number 35 than we were intending. I got super sick on my honeymoon, and John is coming off of being super sick himself. So both of us are coming off of health scares, and John still doesn't have his total voice back yet. Unluckily and luckily for me, it never really affected my voice. But anyway, we're talking Wally. We're talking Ivan's childhood. That's what's going on tonight. But John, how you feeling? How you doing? It has been, I think, literally like 40 days. I think we did a full Survivor season since the last time that we actually podcasted together.
I'm feeling great being able to talk about movies again. It just brings so much joy. I was sitting there all day just anticipating this moment to be able to talk about these two movies, one that I really, really enjoy and one that I really don't enjoy.
Which is so funny because I know, John, you were sick, but your brain doesn't have to turn to mush every time you get sick. Like, you're allowed to not like things, but you're supposed to not like things that aren't good. But anyway, I'm curious, did you see Lightyear or no?
I have not seen it, no.
Okay, I'm just curious to see. If you give that a higher rating than Wally, I might find a new podcast host, but that shouldn't deter you from giving it a higher rating than Wally, because at the end of the day, it is what it is. We are going to start with Ivan's childhood, because it's obviously the less popular choice. But I do see the only comment we have over here on the right is from Caleb Dunaway. Recap the challenge at CBS, lots of Survivor people, and the first episode was amazing. Just want to get this out of the way right now. Patreon.com/Survivor Specialist. John and McKenna Feeney both podcasted about episode one, an hour and a half long podcast, and John's voice was worse than it is right now. So lots to look forward to. But they did recap it for our patrons. It's for the $20 patrons, because at the end of the day, they're the ones who are getting really nothing during this time period, and they're the ones who are giving us the most, so we should be giving them the most. So they are recapping the challenge all year long, coming out every Thursday morning. So just keep an eye out for that. But all that being said, John, Ivan's childhood, Andrei Tarkovsky's first movie, and I think this is our first dive into Tarkovsky officially on this podcast. Explain to me why you love this kind of depression, whereas I love melancholy depression.
Yeah, I mean, this is, for anyone who's never seen Ivan's childhood before, this is an experience. And this is what got me really into Soviet cinema, into Tarkovsky itself as a major introduction to Tarkovsky. I took a Russian cinema course during my first year of university, and I think this was like the third movie we watched after like Battleship Potemkin and a couple other ones. But this was my introduction to Tarkovsky. I absolutely loved it. I loved absolutely every approach Tarkovsky takes to this film. This is, in my opinion, one of, if not the single greatest World War II movie ever made. And you don't see a single piece of action in this film. Mm-hmm. It's all just character focused. It's all contained. It's beautiful. I just remember seeing this cinematography, and like, this was the moment where I was opened up to international film. Like, I had seen foreign language films prior to this, but this was the moment where I was like, I need to watch more of these.
Yeah. I get how that would have that kind of impact. I mean, when it comes to just the way that this movie looks, the performance by the child, I'm assuming that's Nikolai Berdyaev, that's him. He just, like, it's such a great performance, but the realism of this, and I just dropped my pen, but the realism of this is what I think is so impressive. Mm-hmm. Tarkovsky had only made student films before this. This was his first real feature length, like, professional movie. And I think it just gets into what's so harrowing about this time in Soviet Russia. Like, he is able to capture it all so amazingly. Just the barrenness, the hopelessness, all of that stuff. It's just all there. And it's funny because this week in this month, I watched the movie Reds, the Warren Beatty, Diane Keaton movie. And it's set during like 1920s Russia, 19-teens or Russia. Mm-hmm. It's America. They go to Russia because they're communist sympathizers, and that's why they keep going. But it gets into that, just like how horrible Russia was to live in these time periods where there were so many promises made and so few promises kept. And here we have the story of this war told through the eyes of a child. Mm-hmm. And obviously this is coming, you know, this is at a different time. This isn't the same era as Reds, but still, like, to have this told from the point of view of a child who lost his family, and the beautiful imagery of these flashbacks and these dreamlike sequences. And you know the entire time this kid's going to die. Like, you just know that it's going to happen. But Tarkovsky gives you the hope that this stubborn little kid is just going to get through. And realistically, with World War II, this was one of the few times where Russia was, like, considered the hero of the situation mm-hmm. that was going on. They're so often portrayed as the villains. This was an instance where they were portrayed as the hero. And yet this movie still dives so hard into how horrible of a time this was to be a Russian and just to exist in any part of Europe that was involved in this war. It was just terrible. So, yeah, I mean, it's beautiful to look at for all its disgustingness.
Yeah, Tarkovsky does this fantastic setup at the very beginning of the film by giving us, like, that ethereal dreamlike sequence mm-hmm. where it feels like childhood. It feels like childhood whimsy. And then it's starkly contrasted by Ivan crossing the river, like, in this desolate, barren wasteland. Yeah. And then when we finally see him talking, he's talking as if he's, like, this hardened war veteran. And it's that contrast and that dichotomy that Tarkovsky puts forward that really propels this film and really helps establish Tarkovsky as one of the greatest filmmakers ever.
Yeah. Yeah, and I always love watching a director's first movie. Like, you look at Roman Polanski, first movie was Knife in the Water. You know, Knife in the Water mm-hmm. is so indicative of what Polanski would become. You look at something like Stanley Kubrick's, Killer's Kiss, or not Killer's Kiss. What's the other one? I can never remember because it's not very good, but it's still, you know, okay. Hold on, let me pull up. Fear and Desire. That's what it is. Not a good movie. Like, you can see where Kubrick is going with it. Like, you can see where the talent is and what somebody with money could do. What's amazing is Tarkovsky, this was his first movie. And he wasn't being backed by Hollywood. You know, nowadays you see all the time, like, you'll get first-time directors who are taking on, like, a Marvel movie just because it fits whatever Marvel is trying to get their director to be. There's no talent involved with directing a Marvel movie. I hate to tell everybody. Like, anybody can direct a Marvel movie because you have $300-400 million that they're like, just go do whatever the hell you want and make sure there's explosions and people are happy. To do this as a first film is really unbelievable, because you're dealing with really heavy, heavy, heavy stuff. And you're dealing with war without showing war. That is normally a flaw of first-time films. Like, let's be real. A lot of mm-hmm. these first-time films, like even these masterpieces, a lot of the complaints will always come from, well, the movie's about this, but we never see that. You know, Blair Witch Project, which I think is a great movie, right. And I know you have super high. One of the biggest complaints about that movie is you don't see anything. Nothing happens. Yeah. It's just noises, like whatever. And that frustrates people. And yet Tarkovsky is able to do this in a way that gets every single point he's trying to make across in such a phenomenal way that you can't help but watch it the entire time. And what I was amazed about with this movie, being that I had seen Solaris and it's totally different than this,
yeah.
I was amazed how entertaining this movie was. Because mm-hmm. ultimately, this movie has a great setup that leads into a great middle and a great end, and it moves along at a quick pace. I was not expecting that at all. I really wasn't, just based on the rest of his filmography. And I got to give credit for that, because a lot of times first-time directors too, even way back in 1962, were so concerned with their own egos that they forgot they were supposed to make something really, really good as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Tarkovsky is really interesting because his first, like, his film thesis, The Steamroller, The Violin and the Steamroller, is readily available. I mean, I own a copy of it. So it's really interesting to see his thesis, which is a lot more I mean, it's more modern. It's dealing with, you know, people and interactions and stuff. Move into Ivan's childhood and then where, because it's nowhere near as artsy as Ivan's childhood. It doesn't go for this like surrealism that Ivan's childhood puts forward, because, and what Tarkovsky does so well with those flashbacks or dream sequences or whatever they are, he shows us what Ivan's childhood should be.
Mm-hmm.
And like, yeah, that's what just drives home every theme in this film, is he's showing you what Ivan should be doing. Ivan should be running along the beach. He should be looking into the well with his mom. He should be sitting on the back of an apple truck with a little girl.
Yeah.
He should be able to do that, but he's not. Instead, he has to witness the front lines of World War II, mm-hmm, and realize that he is one of the most important people to the Russian army, because he can actually scout ahead because he's, mm-hmm, so small. It's so heartbreaking, this entire movie. But Tarkovsky just paints it in a way where you're so compelled to go along with it, despite the fact that you know it's going to end in disaster.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. I totally agree with like all of that. And I mean, ultimately, what I love about these, what I love about watching older war movies is how negative all of these war movies are. And, mm-hmm, and that's something, obviously, when you're younger, it gets lost on you. You don't really understand like what's going on. But like, I rewatched Apocalypse Now during this last month. And Apocalypse Now and Ivan's childhood are very similar in their depictions of what's going on. Like they're happening just because they're happening. Like, and it's very dark and everything is sinister and everything is horrible and whatever. And it takes like, this one is showing the effects it has on everybody from adult, mm-hmm, to child, and how a child should be the furthest thing away from war. And then with Apocalypse Now, it's taking a guy on the verge of a mental breakdown, or who is in the middle of a mental breakdown, and puts him into this pointless journey through a pointless war to get to this pointless, like it's all pointless. And like, that's another thing that's so well done with this, is it's like, he's showing this is what this child's life should be. This is what life really is. And we have turned around and made everything about this person's life meaningless. Even the meaning that he is finding is meaningless, because what is he really doing? He's helping them get intel from the other side because he can sneak around. For what? For what? Like, it's not like, it's all meaningless. If I forget what movie it is, it might've been Apocalypse Now, but there was a movie recently that I just watched where they say something along the lines of like, if men weren't so obsessed with blowing each other up, there would be no war. And that's what this movie is. They're finding meaning in this little kid getting them intel from the other side just because they're killing the other side. If they weren't killing the other side, there would be no meaning to this little kid having to go and do that. And I think like, just how it dives into the pointlessness of everything is really fantastic. And, you know, ultimately war is pointless, right? I mean, for the most part.
I really like how Tarkovsky decided to make all of the people in the front line quite young in this, mm-hmm, film. And he, because the oldest characters we see are all back at HQ. They're all sitting on the back, and we see these young people engaging with everything. And I really like that Tarkovsky's just showing the fact that like, it's the youth who are affected by war. Like, yes, everyone is, but the youth are especially affected because they're the ones who are putting their bodies on the line all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The youth ultimately are the ones. It's the 18, 19, 20, 21 year olds. And even in this case in Russia, it was whatever age we could get you at. Those are the ones who are perfectly healthy and are dying. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not the older people. It's not 70 year olds. Yeah, sure. Cities get bombed and bad things happen, or cities are getting ravaged, you know, throughout Europe during World War II all around. But it was the young, healthy people who were the most lost lives. And how pointless was that? All of those people who died, why, like, what was the point? And, you know, Ivan's childhood, we see like what he was doing, what he is doing now because of the war. And it ultimately leads to him just being butchered, like he was a serious spy or something. He didn't know what the hell he was doing. He was doing it because they were telling him to do it, but he's treated like any other prisoner of war. And that, I think, is like the most disturbing thing about all of it, is that children were murdered just as quickly as adults if they were working on the other side, because they were collecting intel. They didn't, like, you know what the hell they were doing. That's why there's laws in place for 16 and up and 18 and up, because that's when people start to actually be able to have their own thoughts. Ivan's 12.
Yeah.
Like, that's it.
Yeah, it's really interesting because Ivan is given this sense of, like, he does know what he's doing. He knows what he has to do. And, like, he's accepted that. But because of these dream sequences, we see that he has no idea what's going on.
Yeah.
We see that he's just, like, living through the days. And, like, these bunkers they're hiding in are depressing with, like, the scrawl of people about to be murdered on the walls. It's a depressing place to be. And it's so interesting when you see at the beginning of the film when they're talking about sending him to military school. Like, they're trying to get him off the front lines, and he's refusing to go. Mm-hmm.
And he has like the I'm trying to think of what's a good comparison, but he's got a death wish. I mean, this kid literally is like saying, I don't want to go to military school. My whole family's dead. I need to avenge them. I need to avenge them. I need to avenge them. Like, you see this all the time in war movies where you get the one character who's like having the mental breakdown and just no longer cares if they die. They're just going to walk straight through the lines of fire and they're going to survive or they're going to get killed and they don't care. To see that from a 12-year-old kid, especially in a movie as early as Ivan's childhood was. I mean, you think this came out the same year as Lawrence of Arabia. This came out before Vietnam had even started. So this was happening before a lot of the classic Vietnam War movies were coming out. A lot of World War II movies were really focusing more on the aftermath of World War II. They weren't really focusing so much on what was happening during World War II. There were a few, but not the classics. Like, From Here to Eternity is all about the buildup to Pearl Harbor. A movie like The Best Years of Our Lives, it's all about coming home. Like, that's what these movies were focusing mainly on. And so to have that mindset that we see as a trope in war movies over and over again, place it in your 12-year-old main character and do it before movies like that were really coming out is so forward thinking. And now when you sit down and you watch the guy who's 25 years old having a mental breakdown and just starts walking through shooting whoever he can shoot, watch a movie like Platoon. Platoon gives you a great sense of these are people who are at their wit's end. It's so much less disturbing because now you've seen it as a child. And even though the child's not holding a gun and walking around, you see this child having no regard for his own life as a 12-year-old because of a war that has nothing to do with him, but has taken everything away from him. It's unbelievably disturbing.
It's brilliant. And it's like you said, Tarkovsky was just so forward-thinking. That's what made him. That's what makes him such an incredible director, is he was so far ahead of the curve when it came to making these films. He saw something in wanting to capture this story, knew how to capture it, so that we were talking about it 60 years later.
Yeah.
And we're talking about it as if this movie should have been made far more recently than it was.
I mean, we're talking about this movie as there's a war between Russia and Ukraine happening.
Yeah.
Exactly. Like, we're literally talking about this movie as Russia is in a war and it's 60 years later. You know, but I think that's what I always find compelling about these like non-true story war movies. Because again, and we'll talk about it when we actually get to like, what was the best thing you watched over the last month? Like, just rewatched Apocalypse Now. Hadn't seen it in like 10 years. Cursing here. It's fucking mind blowing. And that's how I feel with like a movie like this. This was only coming, 20 years, 15 to 20 years on the heels of World War II. We're starting to get into the Cold War era, all that stuff. And it's still able to capture the significance of this. And we see that in the late 70s in American film. And that's why the 70s are generally regarded as the best decade for film in American history, because there was such an edge to everything. There was such a negativity. There was such a hopelessness because of the Vietnam War. It had taken so much out of people. And even if you look at movies that have nothing to do with the Vietnam War, they're generally not very positive movies that are well revered throughout the 70s. Chinatown, Godfather series, like the first two, those are downer movies. Like, you might enjoy and you might laugh at parts, but those are downer, downer, downer movies. And that was just the feeling at that time. And for this movie, Black and White in 1962, one of the most beautiful movies ever made in the history of cinema, came out in 1962 with Lawrence of Arabia. That movie's in color. It is gorgeous to look at from beginning to end. And the technology was there. This was a purposeful choice. Mm-hmm. And it's a choice that works so well because of the content and because of where it's set. And not for nothing, if you live here, because essentially what, Russia's the East, right? Like that's East meets West. Like Russia is the East. You live in the West. Russia does feel like a bleak black and white place. Like that's just what it feels like. And whether Tarkovsky did that because of Western audiences or not, or just because of budget or whatever it was, or just a creative decision like what Spielberg did with Schindler's List, it doesn't matter. But ultimately, it gives me that feeling of I'm watching a timeless movie that is about something that was so harrowing to this entire generation and these all these people. Like, it's just incredibly well done. And, you know, it's hard not to commend. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the choice to use black and white leads itself to, I think, some of the most beautiful scenes in this film, too. Because I think, because everything's so dark for so long. Like, the beginning's incredibly dark, the end's incredibly dark. But we have these moments of contrast throughout the film, specifically the birch forest scene. And that scene, it sticks in your memory. It's so recognizable that, like, if someone showed you a still of this birch forest, you're going to know it's Ivan's childhood. You're going to know exactly this scene that's going on between Kulin and Masha in this forest. You know what's happening here. And it's just such a beautiful scene. And yes, the context of the scene is beautiful itself, but just the way Tarkovsky is able to capture this place is so phenomenal.
Yeah. Yeah, and to set that as a location for this clear, these clear unwanted advances.
Yeah.
But at a time where, what were you going to do? And also getting back to like the humanity of these people. Nobody's good, nobody's bad, and you're being like, it's wartime scenario. And it's trying to get back to like, what are the natural urges of humans? And this guy who knows how long he's been in the war sees Masha and he starts making these unwanted advances. But Tarkovsky takes what could be a brutal scene to watch and what is a disturbing scene to watch. And what is a scene that ultimately could have been cut from the movie. And like you said, turns it into one of the most beautiful scenes in the movie. And makes it feel more purposeful than maybe it is, because it really doesn't affect the overall storyline at all. But it shows how, for the children, it was horrible. For the women involved, it was horrible. And for the men involved, who knows if this guy was actually what he like this prior to being in the war. But clearly this has taken some sort of mental toll on him since it started. And it's capturing all of that in what? This movie's an hour and 30 minutes, like, essentially?
Yeah,
it just, I don't know. Like, he just gets it. He just gets his points across.
Yeah, which is phenomenal, especially when you look at Tarkovsky's later works, which are like 3 hours long and stuff like that, right? Like, Tarkovsky is able to make a film that's short and concise, like Ivan's Childhood, and still be able to make it a masterpiece. Whereas he's able to make things like Andrei Rublev and Stalker, which are great spanning epic films instead. Again, it shows how diverse Tarkovsky is and how he just is this master of his craft.
Yeah, no, I'm looking at Andrei Rublev being 3 hours and 25 minutes and nice. Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely going to watch it. It's just crazy that it's 3 hours and 25 minutes because it's just insane. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what more to say. I mean, Tarkovsky, so this is the second Tarkovsky I've seen. I've seen Solaris. I've seen Ivan's Childhood. I haven't seen the others, but I'm also kind of holding off with Mirror and Stalker just because you have them coming up. But I can definitely say, like, he is somebody who lives up to the hype because he was thinking about things that a lot of people weren't thinking about. And he was portraying it in a way that was very effective. And, you know, a movie like Ivan's Childhood, I'll be honest, I didn't know if I was going to like it or not going in. I had no idea. I could have gone either way. I could have absolutely hated this movie. And I actually ended up enjoying it a lot. And, you know, to me, it's not quite at the level that like The Cranes Are Flying is at, but it is definitely one of those movies that, you know, it is, it deserves to be seen. And it's a shame that as an American film school student at one point, like this movie never gets watched in American film school. Mm-hmm. Instead, we're going to sit down and we're going to watch Rome, Open City, or The Bicycle Thieves. And like, those movies are movies that film kids are going to find anyway. Like, that's just going to happen because Martin Scorsese says The Bicycle Thieves is his favorite movie. Sure, dude. And I swear that's my favorite movie too. Like, no, it's not. It's not your favorite movie. Like, I'm sorry. But at the same time, a movie like Ivan's Childhood doesn't come up as often, but it is hugely influential. And who is Tarkovsky one of the most influential directors on? I don't know if it's going to hurt John or not, but Inarritu. Mm-hmm. Inarritu adores Tarkovsky. And like The Revenant is heavy with Tarkovsky. Like it really is. And I saw that just from this movie. Because Solaris obviously isn't like this at all. But now I'm curious, when I go and watch Stalker, I feel like just from the images I've seen of Stalker, I see where it's coming from. Like where this inspiration comes from. And to have such an inspiring director who goes relatively unnoticed. I don't know if I would have ever watched this movie had you not done this podcast and had it in here and been such a Tarkovsky fan. Because there's a lot of directors that I haven't seen a damn thing from. Robert Bresson.
Yeah.
Never seen a movie. Who knows how long it's going to take me to get to that. But that happens with some of these directors that just don't make their way into the social conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and Tarkovsky's kind of on a different level with his exclusion from things, because when you talk to people who have seen Tarkovsky films or know of Tarkovsky, they can tell you how influential he is, how important he is to cinema. But if you're just talking to people who watch movies, like nowhere just like randomly shows a Tarkovsky film.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. He's not somebody who's like coming up as like I do think a lot of that has to do with the fact that he's Russian. I think that the fact that these movies are Russian movies, that's what's hurting it overall. But I do think that if you showed this movie rather than Battleship Potemkin, and I'm just saying this from a film school perspective, you're going to get kids more interested in Russian cinema by showing them this than Battleship Potemkin, because this is going, they're going to be able to relate to this more than Battleship Potemkin. Battleship Potemkin is a silent movie and it's short and it's quick and it's got one scene that always gets talked about. That doesn't mean it's not a great movie. It just means this is something that younger people are going to react to better. And I think get them involved and then they'll go find Battleship Potemkin. That's just my opinion, though. What do I?
Yeah, I completely agree. There are sequences. I mean, the apple truck sequence in this film, where it, like it flashes between the negative and the positive. It's just such a beautiful film sequence in black and white. Like it's nothing terribly special, but it just brings so much everything to this film. Mm-hmm. And like, why isn't that shown in film school classes?
Yeah.
Like, just to show contrast. Contrast is a thing that you need to know in film. And Tarkovsky captures it wonderfully in black and white in Ivan's Childhood.
Yeah, I totally agree. I totally agree. And some black and white movies, they just have the best of the contrast. What else you have about Ivan's Childhood that you want to talk about? Because I'm talked out. I feel like I've made all my points. So what do you got?
The ending of this film and seeing the Russians in Berlin is such this bittersweet moment. Mm-hmm. And you know, as that one soldier's going through the files, you're like, oh, Ivan's dead. He's going to be in here. Mm-hmm. And it still almost feels a little shocking when you finally see his face on that file folder.
Yeah. Yeah. You there's hope. They give you the hope, but at the end of the day, like this movie couldn't have ended any other way.
No. Mm-mm.
But it's also
we get to see all the ways that he died. Oh, we get that beautiful, beautiful dream sequence to finish the film, though.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's like, I look at that like, that was a very big thing with foreign film at that time. And maybe, even if it wasn't a dream sequence, but finding that, like, I think about Fellini with 8.5 or La Dolce Vita, those final shots of those movies will last with you for your entire life. And that's with Ivan's Childhood, same thing. Because it takes you out of the hard part and it pulls you back into the easier part. And that's why it stays with you. And, you know, Ingmar Bergman was able to do that a lot with his movies and find that beauty. Yeah, that's a skill. That's a tough one for a lot of directors.
For sure.
All right, John, it's been a month. It's been over a month. So you can give me more than one because I got five for you. I got five 4-star movies. I got 5 4-star movies that I watched in the last month. So I want to talk. I want to give each of them like their little praise because a lot of them are unknowns. But what do you got for me, John, is like the best thing you watched or the best couple you watched over this time?
Great question. Because I watched a lot of very mediocre movies over this last stretch here. Mm-hmm. In fact, I only have
go ahead.
3 4-star movies over the last month.
And what were they?
And one of them, Shrek.
Okay, yeah, Shrek is a 4-star movie, though. Shrek's a masterpiece.
The other ones were The Illusionist. I watched that back-to-back with The Prestige because you have to watch them back-to-back because you need to understand that in 2006, both of these movies came out, like, I think in the same month.
Almost simultaneously, yeah.
Yeah, and it was confusing back then, and watching them back-to-back, The Prestige gets a lot of hype because it's like a Christopher Nolan movie. It has Christian Bale and Hugh Jackman and Michael Caine and David Bowie.
Scarlett Johansson.
Scarlett Johansson. It has a massive cast, but it's not very good.
Now, The Prestige, I have, since 2006, I was 14 years old when this happened. Those two movies came out. I thought The Prestige's trailer was amazing. I couldn't wait to watch that movie. I watched The Illusionist and I was like, holy crap. That is a phenomenal movie. Like that, the ending, the setup, it's all acting and storytelling. And yeah, it can get corny at parts, but it is so much fun to watch. It is a hidden gem. It is a masterpiece, masterclass in storytelling. It brings you back to that like time in Vienna, whatever. And then I watched The Prestige and I was like, well, that sucked. And then The Illusionist is a movie I'll watch every couple years. You know, I love watching The Illusionist. I actually watched it this year.
Not too long ago, yeah.
Yeah. And The Prestige, I hadn't seen for a while because I didn't like it. I sat down to watch it right around the time Dunkirk came out because I didn't really love Dunkirk. Right. And I was like, all right, let me watch The Prestige again because I don't remember it. I watched The Prestige and Insomnia just to get an idea. Man, The Prestige is bad. I do not understand why people love that movie. I think it's just because it's Nolan and because like he has such fanboys and it came out at that time. It is a movie. The story is nonsense. There is so much coincidence in that movie that it jumps out of the realm of possibility. There's so much coincidence that happens for any of the twists at the end to make sense. It's so dumb. I really, really dislike that movie. It's probably, other than Tenet, my least favorite Nolan movie, but Tenet was so bad. I just don't get the love for it, but I'm glad you like The Illusionist because I think The Illusionist is probably the most underrated movie of the 2000s, and I'm not exaggerating because that movie is very close to my top 100.
I also saw The Illusionist first back in 2006, and I fell in love with this movie. This movie, the performances in this film are so good. Mm-hmm. Like, Edward Norton is fantastic in the film as this, like, lovelorn character and, like, dealing with everything, but Paul Giamatti in this film, absolutely incredible. Just this stellar performance that no one ever talks about.
No. And not for nothing, Jessica Biel and Rufus Sewell are very good in it, too. Like,
yeah, exactly. You know,
Giamatti steals the show, but they're all very good in it. And, yeah, just a super underrated movie, I think mainly because, you know, it came out at the same time as a more popular movie, so it had bad timing on its side. Yeah. It was directed by Neil Berger before people really knew who Neil Berger was. And not for nothing, now that people do know who Neil Berger is, it's not because they like him. Neil Berger hasn't really done anything good at all other than this movie. But yeah, I just think this is far superior. One of my favorite movies from the 2000s, without a doubt.
Yeah, it's a very good film. And it's one that if you haven't seen, because it did kind of get pushed under the rug because it didn't have all the hubbubaloo that The Prestige had, and it had a similar theme. I mean, there were magicians in both movies.
There's magicians, yeah. That's it. And there's a twist ending. And I'll tell you what.
There's a twist ending, yeah.
The Prestige is a joke compared to this one.
Yeah, this movie is absolutely incredible. Definitely worth a watch. The only other four-star movie I watched was Swiss Army Man.
That's a fun one.
By Daniels with Paul Dano and Daniel Radcliffe. What a weird movie that is, but what a fantastic movie it is at the same time.
That is a wild trip.
Yeah, it starts and it's absolutely ridiculous from the very beginning. Daniel Radcliffe plays a corpse.
Yeah, he's dead the whole movie, guys.
He's dead the entire movie. And it's just this absolute wild ride of discovery and like self-growth and everything. It's just, it's phenomenal. I mean, you have Paul Dano, who's probably one of the best actors in his generation. Mm-hmm. And Daniel Radcliffe, who has just emerged as one of these really good, quirky indie actors. It's a phenomenal film.
Yeah, definitely worth checking out. One of the most unique you're going to watch. All right, I go older here. So all my movies are pretty old, but, you know, pretty old, generally speaking. But anyway, I was with you. I had a lot of mediocre in there. There was a couple movies where I was just like, man, I thought that was going to be better than it was, and then it wasn't, whatever. But I end up with these. So I'm trying to watch all the Best Picture winners, but then at the same time, I'm like, you know what? Let me also start watching the Best Picture nominees because, like, why the hell not? And not for nothing, you go to the library, you can pull them out for free. So why not do that? So if you look at my letterbox now, I have 397 movies on my watch list because I added every Best Picture nominee that I haven't seen. So I started making my way through. I watched Captain Blood, which was Errol Flynn's first movie. Fuck, so much fun. Fun. That's all there is to say about that. I wasn't going to say the F word. I was going to say fun. It's so much fun. Just a good watch. I gave that one 4. Another one I watched. So I was going through 1981 of all the years that Chariots of Fire won Best Picture and beat Reds and Atlantic City. Now, everybody talks about Reds because Reds is the one that everybody feels like should have won. Reds is phenomenal. Like, Reds is such a great movie. It was one of the most unique movies I've ever seen in my entire life. The way Warren Beatty, I'm not the biggest Warren Beatty fan, but the way that he was able to intersperse the documentary with the real story, the true story, make a movie in 1981 about communist sympathizers and have it be a Hollywood hit. That was pretty ballsy, and he does it well. Diane Keaton not winning the Oscar for that is the biggest joke maybe in the history of the Oscars. Diane Keaton is phenomenal in that movie. That same year, Atlantic City came out. Nobody talks about this movie. Burt Lancaster as old man Burt Lancaster. Like, this was like the end of his career, a return to form after being away for a while. Him, Susan Sarandon, it is just a fantastic movie about an old guy who used to mean something in a city that is dying as he's getting older and has no purpose. So simple. So good. So good. So check that one out. The other one that is the best movie I watched for the first time was Purple Rose of Cairo, which is a Woody Allen movie about a woman who is living during the Depression, loves going to the movies, and one day the character just walks off screen and falls in love with her. What a great movie about just loving movies. Like, just a phenomenal look at what it means to just love film and have film have such a big impact on your life. It is so good. It's an hour and 22 minutes long. It flies by. It's got all the Woody Allen wit. Jeff Daniels, Mia Farrow. It's so good. Danny Aiello is hilarious in it. Check it out. And then the best one I watched, and it's going to be in my top 100, and it might be in my top 20. It's ridiculous, is Apocalypse Now. Apocalypse Now is not a movie. The characters don't make decisions because they know they're in a movie. It is just a character study and it's a study of war. And any other movie would have rushed to get to Marlon Brando, rushed to get to Dennis Hopper. It would have kept Robert Duvall around as long as possible, which I love Melvin Douglas and I love being there. No way Robert Duvall should have lost to Melvin Douglas. But it is just such a harrowing portrait of war. And, oh man, it's just devastating. Brutal movie. So intense the entire time. It is so matter of fact. It's not like Coppola's direction in that movie is so unintrusive. It's incredible. Gotta watch it. If you haven't seen it in a while, watch it. It's a masterpiece. It really is. It's just all-time great. All-time great movie. Those are my movies. All right. Talking about WALL-E from 2008, which John didn't like because John has terrible taste. But that's okay because I love it. And so WALL-E came out 2008. Wally was kind of overshadowed in my life. It was a very weird time because if you think about the Pixar movies that were coming out around this time, we had Ratatouille before this, and then Up came out Up right after, and you had Ratatouille before. So you're already kind of lumping this one into the middle a little bit. We also had, you know, Cars, which wasn't very successful after the really good success of The Incredibles and Finding Nemo. And it was like, well, Cars came out. Did they lose their, you know, did they lose their touch? No, because then Ratatouille comes out and Ratatouille is great. But Ratatouille wasn't like a Toy Story or a Finding Nemo. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like a defining thing. And when Ratatouille came out, I'm 15, so I'm in high school. You're not really going to say to your parents, hey, let's go watch an animated movie in theaters. Like, that wasn't happening. So I watched Up at 17, and then I watched Ratatouille, and then I watched Wall-E. So I watched them all in like a jumbled order because I wasn't seeing these in theaters. And I remember watching Wall-E and just saying to myself, like, how did they make a movie for children about a robot that doesn't speak, living on an uninhabitable planet because of corporations? And they send him off to space where he has to save humanity and make humanity learn to be human again and call that a children's movie. And I got so sucked into the story and the elements of it and the way that it just takes its time. And I think for the first 30 minutes of the movie, there's like four lines of dialogue. And I'm just like, what in the, like, how did they do this? To me, it was a movie where I said, they're still making movies for me. Like, Up had that feeling of the in-between. Up had that, like, okay, adventure is out there, and it's the old man and the little kid, but there was still, like, a silliness to that movie. When I saw Wall-E, I was like, they're making movies for adults now. Like, they're not making this just for children. Kids aren't going to run out and be like, I love Wall-E. He doesn't talk, and there's nothing silly that really happens. Like, it's him, a cockroach, and a white robot that has no emotion. And I love every second of it. I think it's just beautifully done. I think the way it has stayed so relevant. If you think about the other Pixar movies, a Ratatouille, it's about a rat who cooks. Like that, anybody can cook. Okay, be yourself, find yourself. Toy Story, who are you? What is identity? Whatever. You know, you start looking at these movies, they are what they are. Wall-E is about the human race. It is about how humanity is imploding on itself. It is just destroying itself. And this is the look at where could we be? Look at this beautiful fade in with Hello Dolly playing in the background. And this fade in over this beautiful city or this smoggy city, whatever it is. And all of a sudden you realize it's mountains of trash. And that's all it is. And there's nothing living here. Only a robot and this cockroach can survive here. And it's just this gray wasteland. And to see where Pixar decides to go with that movie from there and about communication and about how to be human and what happens when technology takes over. And is that a good thing? And look at what's happening to humanity as they become lazier and everything. This movie is essentially like Idiocracy, but with a robot, and it's animated and it's so much deeper. And I just, every time I watch it, it just hits me every time. And I'm just impressed with what they did. I'm impressed with the guts it took to make this movie. And I'm impressed that, like, you know, all these years later, with all the great movies Pixar has made and all the duds too, but with all the great movies, this is the one every time that I go back to, it hits me with the most emotion. I love the end with him and Eve. Like, that just kills me every time. And I also feel like it hits me the most cerebrally. And that does not happen with every Pixar movie because ultimately it's not supposed to. But that's what this movie does for me. And that's why it ends up here at number 35. And there's not another Pixar movie that I think even comes close. That's just my opinion.
Well, my opinion is drastically different about this movie. I think this is one of my least favorite Pixar movies. And I it's funny that you said, like, it kind of slipped by for you based on, like, when it came out. It slipped by for me too. I also did not see this when it first came out. I didn't see this until I was probably in university when I first saw this. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, okay, it's cute. Like, I get it. It's cutesy. I understand the message it's getting at about, you know, humankind, corporation, capitalism, all that. Like, you know, the enviro message behind it, which I'm all here for. Like, it's great. But it never really did anything for me. I didn't get much out of it. And I was like, okay, whatever. We'll throw the skepticism aside. We're going to watch it again for the podcast because Phil loves this movie. So what am I missing? There's a lot of things I appreciate about this movie. I really appreciate the first half hour. I think the first half hour is the best half hour of this movie. Mm-hmm. I really like you're watching this first half hour. You're watching a Charlie Chaplin movie.
Yeah.
Like, it's so obviously a Charlie Chaplin movie that Wally's just the tramp. Mm-hmm. And that's what the beginning of this movie is. And I'm sitting there watching it. First off, the opening sequence is absolutely gorgeous. Like yeah. you said, the artistry that goes into the space going down into the planet and then like zooming over those piles of garbage, absolutely gorgeous. Then you get Wally. You see him literally strip a dead body. Let's not go over that fact here. Mm-hmm. Like, this robot is stealing parts from other robots.
Yeah.
So that's morbid right away. Mm-hmm. With this garbage planet, I guess it helps set the tone for the movie.
It does.
It's really charming. Like, the character of Wally's really charming. Where this movie loses me is when it goes into space. That's where I don't have it anymore. I don't feel that magic that was this Charlie Chaplin robot on Earth anymore. And that's where it starts losing me. And that's where I at that point, the story just becomes, hey, let's find the plant and stop the evil robot. And it's just not as compelling as seeing Pixar just focus on portraying a character without talking.
Well, and so here's why I love when they go to space, because on the surface, what is the A storyline? The A storyline is Wally and Eve's love story, you know, in air quotes. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to save Eve and get the plant so that Eve is safe.
Yeah.
What I love about this movie, though, and why it's my favorite of these movies, is because the B storyline is one of the best B storylines, I think, ever. In this whole Wally starting to wake all these people up from what's happening to them. And while it is the secondary storyline, that's the storyline that is about everything that we see in the first half hour.
Yeah.
What is it to be human? What have these humans done? What do they even realize they've done? Now we're just looking at the offspring of these people who went up there that are so far removed that these people don't even know that there's a world outside of the screen that's an inch from their face. This was made the year after the iPhone came out. Okay, the iPhone came out in 2007. This movie was made in 2008. 14 years later, the iPhone rules our lives. Every single human being who lives in, you know, America and Canada and, you know, is well off enough to own an iPhone. And when I was living in Los Angeles, I'd see homeless people with iPhones. I'm not kidding. Like, homeless people with iPhones that worked. They weren't just something to hold. Like, they were working. So the iPhone is in control. And this movie is looking at what happens when we can't look past that screen. Wait, the new color is blue. Okay, great. We're all going to wear blue because that's what my screen told me to do. Everything is telling me to do this and follow this and do whatever. And it literally takes a robot that doesn't know how to do anything except what it's supposed to do. Get the trash every morning, get up like he's going to work, get the trash. Now this robot finds love and wants to change that. And this robot takes a chance and goes to space and does all of that so that he can try to change things. And in that process, changes what's happening with the humans. And now these humans start coming to life, but they're already so far gone that what can they do to change things? And it takes the captain and it takes the two characters who, you know, are whatever. It takes them starting to help people understand that, like, this isn't what it's supposed to be like. They're drinking their food out of a cup. They're, you know, everything is being told to them. They're just talking and they're just going about on the line. And one of my favorite things about this movie is then when you get into, like, what is the C storyline? It's the other robots that Wally is now waking up. One of my favorite parts is that little cleaner robot that just keeps following him around because he can't handle that it's not clean, but he needs to get off his path in order to do what he feels his purpose is. That's where this movie hits me with the depth that a Toy Story and a Ratatouille and an Up, even though Up is close, and you know, the other classics don't hit me with. And the one thing it has over a movie like Soul is that to me, it's just flat out entertaining. Soul is freaking depressing. Soul is a great movie. Soul is hard to watch. This, there is that childlike wonder that goes into it. And I mean, I love all the allusion by and large and everything like that. One of my, the top Letterboxd review is pretty ballsy of Pixar and Disney to make a movie about a corporation that takes over the world and ruins the earth. You know, interesting. But anyway. I know I just spoke for a while because I can't let you say too many bad things. So go ahead.
I know. But even with those, like, the B and C storyline, those are also just like ripped out of Charlie Chaplin movies.
Yes.
Because it is huge. Like, is it, you see the influence of Charlie Chaplin on these films. I like it. I really do. To me, this film feels like Pixar had an idea for a short. And then they didn't have an idea for a full feature-length film, so they just stretched this out.
See where I disagree is I don't feel like this movie is stretched at all. I understand what you're saying, where it does feel like it's the idea for a short, and I definitely do think it was the idea for a short. But I think this movie has a phenomenal beginning, middle, and end. Of the beginning is on Earth. They take their time. They show that they have a lot of gusto because they sold this movie to us as a trip through space. For a half hour, there's no space. Then they get into space and it's him and Eve. Then it gets into with the captain and how are we going to actually get them back to Earth? Now we know that the goal is to get back to Earth and have these people go back. I think it has a great beginning, middle, and end that a lot of movies where it is being a stretched short, they'll be missing an act or they'll be missing key pieces to an act. This to me doesn't feel like it's missing any of that. Because we're also watching a very easy to see hero's journey from Wally. Do I agree with you that there's Charlie Chaplin, a lot of Charlie Chaplin to this? Absolutely. But at the end of the day, Charlie Chaplin was incredibly popular for a reason. Yes. And I still think the absolute guts that it takes to make a Charlie Chaplin movie for kids in 2008, when Charlie Chaplin hadn't made a movie since what, 50, what was Limelight, 52, 54, whatever it was.
Yeah.
And his last non-speaking movie was what, 30-something?
Yeah.
That's a huge undertaking. Absolutely. And especially coming on the heels of the other movies that Pixar had made. This is 2 years after Cars. Cars is the most run-of-the-mill storyline maybe in the history of Disney. Like, that's saying a lot. Sure, you know, that's just tough. That's a hard thing to do.
No, and I commend them for the ambition it takes to make this film, because this film shouldn't succeed as much as it did, as much as it does. People love this. The people love this film. You love this film.
Love it.
And there are a lot of people who agree with you on that. I just don't want them. And like, there are little things. I watching it this time, I found such a strange disconnect between the images and the score at times. There are times where it just felt like the score didn't fit what was happening on the screen, or that the score totally didn't make sense with the rest of the score. There were a lot of strange, it's not even like juxtaposition for the sake of like nailing home themes or anything like that. It just felt like strange decisions from a composition standpoint that weren't working as a whole and were working as segments instead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, see, I didn't get that at all. I do feel that this is one of the weirder Pixar scores for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think there's any doubt about that. I mean, the music that plays when they're on the run in space and like when they're doing the chases and everything is strange.
Yeah.
But that to me, like I think it works with everything. I don't have that same feel at all, but I mean, you know, that's you're the music guy. So like, you know, that's more of something that you would notice, right?
Yeah, I don't know. It was just something that I picked up on and something that it just like struck me the wrong way. And for someone, I mean, we've already talked about Fantasia and how much I love Fantasia. It felt like this was harkening back on Fantasia. And I think that's fine. I think you can make small vignettes into a massive story. It's one of the problems with Fantasia is that it's small vignettes and there is no cohesive story that people have with that film. Whereas this kind of feels like it could have been the step of taking a cohesive storyline. Like you said, there's three very distinct arcs in the story, or acts in the story. It makes sense from a storytelling perspective. And it feels like they were trying to kind of push that narrative with the score, but it just didn't connect for me. Like you said, like when they're zipping around space, that is some of the weirdest scoring I've ever seen in an animated film. I heard the score. I didn't see the score.
Yeah, you didn't see the score. You saw everything else. Yeah, I mean, look, I can't argue it. Like, I mean, because it's not something like, obviously, that's just your feel on that. And then I don't really know. But I'm also
going to pay attention to that more than the average person is, too. Right. So,
yeah.
It's one of those things.
The one thing I do want to ask you, though, and as like just because like if we talk about the story and things like that, that made you think about the stretch that Pixar went on here, where in 2007 they made Ratatouille. In 2008, they made WALL-E, which clearly John doesn't like, but that's OK. In 2009, they made Up. And in 2010, they made Toy Story 3.
Yep.
You could sit here and argue that any of those four movies are the best Pixar movie. Now we're 12 years later. Lightyear just came out. Not very well reviewed. Not nearly as bad as what some critics were saying. But, you know, not the best reviewed movie. What do you think has happened with Pixar that has made them not as brave as they were? Because whether you like WALL-E or not, which you're wrong, I'm right, but whether you like WALL-E or not, the one thing you can say is making a movie about a rat who cooks, making a movie about a robot who doesn't talk, who goes into space to save humanity, making a movie about an old man and a kid who fly in a house that has balloons, and then making a movie about toys who almost die in an incinerator. And now they're making, if you start looking back, Lightyear, it's about a space ranger who goes into space and does things. Turning Red, I understand, is a little bit different with the, you know, giant red panda and all that. But you look at a movie like Luca, Soul, obviously a different thing, but Onward starts to get back to being pretty basic. Toy Story 4 wasn't as well received. The Incredibles 2 kind of seems like it's just going through the motions. Coco, another really good one. Then you had Cars 3, Finding Dory. Like, what do you, like, if you start to think about what these movies are, they're sequels to really good, like, really good creative originals, but that doesn't necessarily mean the sequel is. Or they're just, they feel kind of cut and dry, with the exception of, I would say, Soul and Coco. Why do you think they've kind of lost the bravery as they've gotten to the point of they can't crumble, they're too successful?
Because people are more vocal now than they were back then.
Yeah.
That's what it comes down to. Like, the power of the internet has changed drastically. And I also think it's the fact that, like, Disney's so spread thin at this point between all of their studios that you're not just, you have to make something that's going to make money, essentially, with that, right? They print money with Star Wars movies and Marvel movies, and Pixar should have the liberty to experiment like they have previously, but look at them trying to experiment. Look at the response they got to Turning Red, right? Like, Turning Red, I thought, was absolutely hilarious. I loved that movie. It was so much fun. And people got on it because of the subject matter, because they were pushing those boundaries as to what they could talk about and things like that. So I don't know. And now you're even looking at it. It's also the streaming service aspect of it, right? Lightyear was the first Pixar movie released in theaters since Toy Story 4.
Yeah, it was since COVID. I forget what was the, it was the one before Soul, whatever came out before Soul. Which was,
so it would have been Toy Story 4 then, right?
Onward, but Onward was barely, I actually saw Onward in theaters. But it was only in theaters for about a month. Toy Story 4 was the one that got an actual release because it wasn't cut short.
Yeah, so I think now might be the time where they start experimenting again. I think they need to. I think Pixar needs to reach out because we've talked about it several times. We've talked about it with the best picture noms or the best animated picture noms this year. Mm-hmm. Disney's very formulaic now, and it's tired and boring. We're seeing that not only in their animated features, we're seeing that with, I mean, Marvel movies have been formulaic for a decade at this point. Even Star Wars movies have become formulaic, and they're focusing so much on TV now that they need to just push the boundaries when it comes to film again. Mm-hmm. They need to swing for the fences, and they just have to accept that, yeah, they might lose money, but they might make a good film.
Yeah, and I think that was like where back in the day, you know, when a Pixar movie would come out, it was must-see. I mean, were, oh, okay, like the next Pixar movie came out, like it's must-see, it's must-see. Now, granted, once Cars came out, I didn't see Cars in theaters, but that was when I was starting to get into like, you know, Rotten Tomatoes, things like that. Yeah. And all of a sudden, it didn't get great reviews. So, okay, we're not going to see it. Well, then you had Ratatouille, must see. WALL-E, must see. Up, must see. Toy Story 3, must see. And then Cars 2 was the biggest disaster. And then they made Brave, which didn't really do anything for them. And then they made Monsters University, which was a sequel, 12 years in the making. And then they made Inside Out, which a lot of people liked. It was different. It was unique. I personally don't like that movie, but it is a different, unique movie. And then but that same year, The Good Dinosaur, which is super basic. Finding Dory, which is a sequel. Cars 3, which is a sequel. Coco, yeah. Okay, good. We're getting there. And back to Incredibles 2 and back to Toy Story 4. And they keep going back to the sequels and stuff. And like what I love about WALL-E, to bring it back full circle, is that WALL-E is a movie that is going someplace that animated movies weren't going. At least not animated movies that were directed at children and adults.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, sure. There were animated movies like, what's that? Final Fantasy Spirits Within. Like, that was meant for adults. That was doing something weird. It's not a very good movie, but it's doing something different. Okay, but that was not meant for children. WALL-E is taking such a chance. And WALL-E made money at the box office. WALL-E wasn't a box office flop. Pixar had their first big box office flop this year with Lightyear. And don't tell me it was because, well, they didn't know if it was going to stream soon. No, no, no. Minions just killed it at the box office. So there's clearly something there. And the Minions Despicable Me franchise is nowhere near as popular as the Toy Story franchise. So you don't give me that. Lightyear just wasn't very good. It was an okay movie. And you took who was arguably the most exciting character in the franchise, and maybe the most exciting character that they ever did with Pixar, and you Han Solo'd him with Solo. Yep. Like, you ruin the mystique, you ruin the mystery. And while I can still, like, it was still, like, I enjoyed Lightyear, don't get me wrong. Yeah. But that movie comes out in 2022, WALL-E comes out in 2008, and WALL-E's the groundbreaking one. And Lightyear, which was a movie that people should have been ready to go see no matter what, because it's about Buzz freaking Lightyear, does nothing to push what storytelling Pixar is telling or take any real chances. You can say that having a same-sex couple kiss is taking a chance. In 2022, that's not taking a chance. And also, it had nothing to do with the story. And honestly, it made part of the story not make very much sense. So it's just one of those things where it's like, how do you go beyond that? How do they get back to where they were when they had that run of four movies? Where even when Toy Story 3 was a sequel, it felt like it had the same love and care that Toy Story 1 and Toy Story 2 had. Toy Story 3 generally considered the best Pixar movie. Like, that is generally considered the best Pixar movies. Now when they make a sequel, it doesn't feel like it has that same TLC. And I just wonder, when am I going to see another Wall-E? When I say another Wall-E, I'll even speak to you, John. Whatever your favorite animated movie is by Pixar, when are you going to see another one of those? And I think that's where my biggest problem is like, I saw Wall-E, and if I would have seen them in order, I just had to wait one more year to find something that was a masterpiece and that was pushing boundaries and that was taking me to a new world or a new place. Now I've had to wait 10 years, close to 10 years. Soul is the closest thing, but Soul is just so heavy. Soul kills me. It's so hard to watch because it's so good, but it's just so dark. Good for them for doing that. But then again, that went to streaming. How would that have done in a box office? I have no idea. And would that have changed their perspective if it did go to the box office and did terrible? Because I can't watch many more Lucas and Lightyears.
Yeah,
I can't watch any more like average animated movies. I don't need to waste my time. Pixar should make me need to get up off my ass and get to that movie theater as quickly as possible.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, in the end, when it comes to Wall-E, I respect the people who enjoy this movie because I do see why people would enjoy this movie. I see why people would be passionate about this movie. Like I said, it just doesn't do it for me. And it's just one of those things. And I don't think you're wrong and I'm right, because I know you're right for you. And that's what matters here.
Yeah. 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 Wall-E made $223.81 million. Lightyear is not even going to come close to that, obviously. Onward got screwed because of COVID. I'm just looking at this from perspective here. Yeah, Incredibles 2, Toy Story 4, those made good money. You know, Cars 3, obviously not. So it's interesting just to look back and see that a movie like Wall-E could still make $223 million, be a huge box office success, be a great movie that makes you think about things differently, takes a lot of chances. I don't know. I mean, was Soul released to Disney Plus because they knew it was a great movie and they weren't really convinced it was going to make them very much money? Maybe. But where's the magic? Where's the magic, Pixar? Yeah. Where's the magic? Get back to the magic. I need the magic. That's kind of a sidetrack, but I just want my magic back. That's all. I just want my magic. I want to go sit in the theater and be like, wowed when I watch a Pixar movie again. And that hasn't happened for me probably because I didn't see Coco in theaters. I should have, but I didn't. I've not been wowed by a Pixar movie since 2010 when I sat down in theaters and watched Toy Story 3. But anyway. All right, John, anything else you want to rip me apart for no freaking reason?
I'm not ripping you up. I literally just said that I wasn't ripping you apart.
Well, maybe you should, man. Maybe you should, because now I got to watch your shit movie next week of Halloween and, you know, whatever. So next week we're moving into number 34, which for me is The Royal Tenenbaums and for John is Psycho. I have Psycho higher up, so we're going to be watching Halloween for John. Instead, the OG 1978, please don't watch one of the other ones that is aptly titled, Halloween and isn't actually Halloween. One of those things, the original one, the original John Carpenter and The Royal Tenenbaums. So that's what we got next week. We are kicking off a lot of horror movies coming up here. Halloween next week, Blair Witch Project the week after, then we take a break and then we go Rosemary's Baby, Fire Walk With Me might as well be a horror movie.
It's a horror movie.
And then we take a 2-week break and then we go into The Witch. So we have a lot coming up. We just like horror movies. So yeah, we're ready for that. We have a bit of a stretch. And by the time we hit October, we just get into depressing movies. Cause why would we have our horror movies line up? Right. But hey, what can you do? What can you do? Although Psycho might be in line to hit around October. I think maybe like 15, 20 weeks from now. That could be around Halloween. But anyway, we're going to be a lot more consistent with this now that we're both back. We're both feeling better. We're both on our way to recovery. assuming next week we'll probably do Thursday again. The following week after that, we'll have to figure something out because I'm not going to be around on Thursday, so we'll have to figure that one out. But just stay tuned. Thank you all for listening. Thank you all for coming back. We had quite a few people watching live here today, which was nice to see because that hasn't, you know, to see good numbers when you haven't done it in a while is always nice. But thank you all for listening. Thank you all for watching. Enjoy your summers, and we'll see you next week with Halloween and the Royal Tenenbaums.